And that's why I said, sweetheart, that's why we have a jury system. But thank you for joining Pretend We're Football for this hour. My name is Johnny Brashear, a.k.a. Bitter White Guy. I am here alongside Tim Preston, and he's from Inside Texas. You know him from various Twitter handles, which you don't ever see any activity from. And also, Will Baser is technically here in spirit, sort of. He's producing. He's a bit under the weather. And so it is my job to run this tonight, which I'm sure will go fantastically, because you know how I like to stay on topic.
Really, the moral of this story is that, Johnny, there is a sickness coming for you.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, isn't that always the moral of the story with me, regardless of podcast or documentary about my life? So tonight, we will talk today, tonight, this morning, depending on when you're listening, we will be talking about, the TCU game, what we took from that, why it was the worst thing ever, or why it was only the second worst thing ever. And, we will also talk about, Shaka Smart, who is the topic of the hour. He and his job status are up for quite a bit of debate, depending on who you are. So we're going to go into that. We're going to talk about how secure his job status is, if there are ways he can save it, and if there are any other options on the table. So before that, we have a relatively abbreviated Pretend You're Getting to Know Us, since there are two of us participating. Tim, the topic is... Oh no, Will has been kidnapped. What is the demand by the kidnappers to get Will back? Tim?
Well, the fun part about doing this on Skype when we're all together is kind of twofold. The first is I get to stare into both of your beautiful faces for the better part of 2.5 hours.
That's mutual, buddy.
Yeah, man. Big time. Big time. I wish that camera panned down a little bit, but... one of the cool things about seeing Will's crib, and I think crib is the appropriate moniker there, is he's got a bunch of cool shit. He's got a lot of, like, Texas memorabilia, and he's got a badass foosball table directly behind his right shoulder. I can just imagine all of the times where he has his really good friends over, and they play a lot of really fun games there. So maybe like some of his memorabilia, but even as much as that's awesome, the thing that I think would really stick out about Will is how frickin' loaded his parents are. So it's got to be some type of huge amount of money that his parents are just going to go ahead and write a check, or like that would be the good thing though too. Like I'm getting like this vibe of Will's dad on TV, and Will's obviously, like, they've sent pictures of Will just struggling and he's tied up, and Will's dad has this huge, like, vat of money behind him, and then he says, "This is what I would give you, except for I'm gonna give it to the person who finds you and kills you and brings my Willy back." Ransom? Is
ransom,
that the...
That's Ransom. Yeah, that's Ransom.
Yeah, okay, so just Will's dad being... So, you know what? Will's dad's not paying shit. Not paying shit. He's gonna find the people himself. Or yeah.
All right. So, breaking news. Will's dad is Mel Gibson. So that's a no wonder he's loaded. Awesome. Congratulations, Will.
There's a strange Jewish thing going on there though too. Yeah, I'm not certain how that Mel Gibson with that.
As long as you can get past his dad's rants about the Jews, he's gonna get a lot of cash. So congratulations. And he has to watch A Passion of the Christ like every other week, just because. So my answer is that Will's kidnappers, who sound a lot like Will in a high-pitched voice, honestly, like, I don't, almost enough that you might suspect it's just Will, that he's just really, it's more like an early Christmas list than anything, but he swears it's a kidnapper, so we're going to go with the kidnapper. He wants lots of lacrosse sticks and a 4K copy of the SpongeBob series, which seems reasonable, honestly. Like, that seems like a doable ransom request, like in the realm of things. Like, right. I think
you go to Best Buy, I'll hit up Played Against Sports. It's gonna be awesome.
although I would love to see like Will's dad on network TV with a bunch of lacrosse sticks and like Blu-rays in front of him being like, this is what I would give the kidnapper, but instead I'm going to give it to whoever kills Will's kidnappers.
Yeah.
That's when
Will hops on Twitter is like, oh, good news. I'm fine.
I'm alive in San Antonio. Amazing. I escaped bondage. Don't worry about it. It's cool.
Dick's last resort is rough.
I had to do some things. I don't want to talk about it. Let's just say I was in a fugue state and it's done. So, all right. So, on that note, I'm just going to assume Will strapped a beer to his face because we're supposed to keep this clean. So on that note of being kidnapped and forced to watch things you don't want, let's talk about TCU.
Nope, not doing it. I'm not talking about shit.
Nope. You've been kidnapped. You've been forced to watch that curses. TCU game.
This is the game I would let you watch. Right?
So, Tim, why don't you give some initial thoughts of maybe overarching thoughts about the TCU game, sort of maybe micro or macro, what you took from it?
Okay. Well, you know, there's not much good to take there, clearly. That was an example of a couple of teams that were in, I guess you could probably say, very similar circumstances as far as kind of desperately needing a win to salvage whatever could be salvaged left of their season. And certainly, I think, a season for both of those teams that was significantly lesser than they both had hoped for going forward. So from a macro level, I expected there to be two teams that had a lot to play for, because I think that's the truth. From a micro level, it was a microcosm of everything that has been super frustrating about Shaka's time. We had very little dribble penetration with the exception of Coleman. We struggled to create any off-ball movement offensively. We lost the hottest shooter of the game again and again and again. We struggled on the glass. We didn't get to the free throw line as much as we probably should, given our athleticism. It was just it was an example of how this system, particularly on offense, when we're expecting players to just make plays, right, to beat their man, when that doesn't happen, particularly over a prolonged period of time inside of a game, just how weak and ineffective this team can be. And you hate to harp too much on not having Kerwin, but this was another game where I think he kind of would have helped. Maybe if he would have been on Bane a little bit more, or if we would have had him to kind of penetrate a little bit more. I don't know. But it was incredibly frustrating to watch this team come out with kind of everything to play for, especially having gotten beaten down like they did at Tech earlier in the week, and they just didn't execute at all on either end of the floor.
So let me ask you, I got two questions. We'll take them one at a time.
Sure.
Do you think...
Throw them both at me. Throw them both right away. I'll answer them both.
So the first one is defensively. I felt like the issue with Bane was not, I mean, yes, he was hot. He was hitting good. He was hitting big shots. I felt like part of the issue with that was okay. So Will's good for sound effects. We got sound effects out of Will. All right.
For sure. Tom Hardy. I guarantee
you're right. I'm sorry. Will's been kidnapped. That was Tom Hardy making a cameo appearance on the podcast. So with Desmond Bane, do you think that it was a matter of him being hot, a matter of them helping too far off, or was there some other defensive lapse that you saw?
We didn't stay in front. I mean, so when we were helping, yes, kind of all the above for the most part. you know, one
that
of the
only
things...
counts as one question.
Yeah, oh, curses. One of the things that we've seen with Jace in particular is teams that have really shut him down have just keyed on him. You know, they haven't helped off of him. They have essentially face guarded him out to like 26 feet. They have made it really difficult for him to find any openings unless spacing happens because we've been able to kind of penetrate so well in the game against Iowa State. But in this game, I thought TCU did a good job of using ball screens, particularly on the wings. They did a lot of stuff kind of out from the high wing, which forced us to make some decisions with our bigs. We didn't hedge very well, so even as we kind of showed a little bit, TCU was able to get around us a decent amount. And the smart thing to do if we're not going to hedge is to help off, except for they kept on putting Bane on the weak side high wing. And so because we helped over and over and over, he was open over and over and over. And it just felt like, okay, how many threes do you want to hit today, sir? Because we're going to allow you to have that many opportunities. And it's not the wrong decision to help, right? Like, it's not the wrong decision to help. I mean, that's the smart defensive play unless you have a guy who's hot like that. And that's a tough thing to do because, look, so much of Shaka's system on both ends of the floor is, all right, if this is a situation, here's what we want you to do, either defensively or offensively. Like, we want you to take advantage of of where you have some advantages. We want to give you an opportunity to say, hey, if this is you defensively and you've got this look, this is our set, and then through this set you can make some of these decisions. And I think that for the most part for our system, we were making the call that we generally make, and it was the wrong call over and over and over, and it ended up killing us.
Yeah, and I think I think I generally agree there. I think it's with help defense, it is generally proper to help off the outside guy to try and cut off the lane. But at the same time, if a guy is 4-for-4, about to go 5-for-5 from three, I'll give up the two over the three. Mm-hmm. Because Bane is one of the best shooters in the Big 12.
Sure.
If not the best, maybe DeZaga was better. You know, maybe there's a couple other guys that are better, but he's right up there. Mm-hmm. If you're going to, you just can't help off that guy. I wish they were giving, well, maybe they gave the same scouting report to Texas that they get, that TCU gets about Jace Febres, where they say just face guard him and you'll help, or and you'll be good, or good enough. And maybe those guys didn't listen. I don't know. I tend to think that they didn't execute because Shaka and his staff tend to be really big on analytics and metrics and stuff. So
yeah,
I think it was probably a lack of execution. So the other question I have, and I have seen this bandied about by a number of people online and, you know, on radio, et cetera, is that they felt like Texas gave up in the second half. So do you think that they gave up?
That's a strong statement. I don't know that I would ever say that about any team. I would say they did not look very engaged. Which, okay. I guess is, I don't think I would ever be prepared to say a team gave up. So whatever the next most damning statement I can say, I suppose I would go that far.
Okay.
Because I thought that from about the 10-minute mark of the first half through the rest of the game, it looked like a very deflated, a very disengaged Texas team.
Okay. My view of this, and it's a very mixed bag based on who you're looking at within the team. I didn't feel like this team gave up at any point. I thought that especially the first, 10 minutes or so of the game when they got up to 22-16 or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. I thought they were definitely engaged. If anything, they were too engaged. They got too sped up. And I think that's one of the things TCU did really well is they sped Texas up way faster than they're comfortable being. Especially, and I think that worked to TCU's benefit, even though Lance Blank seems to think that an increased tempo favors both teams for some reason. Never mind the English definition of the word favor. I sensed I would call it frustration. Like I sensed from a number of players sort of like maybe in the second half, sort of as the lead ballooned, maybe it was a deflation as you call it. I felt like it was frustration, deflation. It kind of varied by player. Like there were some players, like Courtney Ramey is the one I'm thinking of specifically, who it seemed like he was really trying to spark something. Mm-hmm. Like he was playing, he's playing high pressure defense as best he could. He was going for steals. He was trying to get out in transition. Like it seemed like he didn't give up. Mm-hmm. And other players, it felt like it really varied by player. Is I guess what yeah. I'm saying. Like I don't want to say the team gave up because I don't think they all had the same reaction. And maybe the fact that they sort of splintered into individual reactions is its own sort of damning statement rather than them being cohesive as a team. But it just felt like some of the guys still were really into it and really trying to do stuff. I mean, they were all frustrated / deflated, but from there, they each went a different way, you know? And I don't recall seeing anybody individually give up. Maybe some guys gave 80% instead of 100%. I mean, frankly, once it hit like, what was it, 19 points or what, or 20 points, I sort of gave up. So maybe I missed some cues that I would have seen otherwise. It feels a little reductive to say that the team gave up because I don't think that's technically accurate.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I think we're maybe you don't want to get into semantics too much, but I do think if give up might not be the right word. However, stopped taking the initiative that is ultimately important in this offense and ultimately important in this defense would be where I would go with that. So it's such an important piece of what Shaka is preaching that when we have our advantages, when you get a look and you can turn the corner, that you do turn the corner. When you have an open three, that you step into it confidently. You know, when you have a chance to get a deflection, that you take that chance.
Yeah.
And I didn't see a team that was, I mean, really emotionally, I didn't see a team that was emotionally ready to fire on all cylinders like that. And against, you know, and TCU came out like they thought that it was a huge game.
Yeah.
You know, that I was not prepared for them to come out as hot as they did, and bless their hearts, they did, I guess so. But yeah, it did not feel like, whether we didn't take the game seriously, whether we thought that, hey, that, you know, we're just expecting for TCU to be deflated, whether, you know, they were surprised that TCU's game plan was what it was. I mean, whatever the rationale, it certainly felt like we weren't taking care of our business emotionally.
Yeah, I think what I would say is, and this may be pedantic, but I'm trying to be specific here, is that it would probably be accurate to say that they lost cohesion. Like they stopped in some ways being a team and they started being a series of individual players reacting individually when this is a team game that you really need everybody giving the same amount of effort, being, you know, all pointing in the same direction. And some guys really gave a damn and kept going. And some guys, I mean, they all gave a damn. It's just like they all reacted to that problem differently. And that's, you know, in some ways, I guess that's, I mean, that's on the coaching staff, that's on the players, it's on the culture that they're trying to build, and or their inability to build the culture that they want.
Sure.
I think, I mean, I guess that's probably a good point to sort of talk about. Like, is this, I mean, if we want to go macro with this, is this sort of where maybe your opinion of Shaka's long-term potential changed, or is this where you felt like we sort of crossed the Rubicon? Like, what are your thoughts on, is this a signifier of something larger, or is this the, I don't know, the end result of a long series of problems? Like, where are you at on kind of, I mean, I guess the point I'm trying to get, or the question I'm trying to get at is, does this game materially affect how you feel about the Texas program? Like, is it the catalyst for you to change how you feel about the program, or is it sort of a consolidation of the way you already felt about it?
I don't know. It got to the point with Rick where his last year, it just sort of felt like, all right, well, this is the end. You know, this is just sort of what it is. And they had a talented roster, and that roster couldn't kind of get their crap together. And it ended up where I don't think there would be anybody who looked at what happened those last couple of years and say, oh, well, no, just give Rick one more year. He's going to get it together. Like, pretty much all of us were like, all right, this is what it's going to be. And I know that it sounds crazy. I just don't know that I'm there with Shaka yet. Like, if he is done, if this is the end, you know, I won't fight it. I won't rail against it. But there's something in me that leads me to believe there's more to a Shaka-led program than what we're seeing right now, that he has the ability to get a team playing better than he has so far with us. However, where I'm going to kind of counteract my own statement there is, I don't know how we can, I mean, not that you would ever ignore them in the past, but this is one of, to me, five extraordinarily damning games from this season, of the home loss to Radford, the home loss to VCU, the home loss to Providence, the loss at Oklahoma State, and now this loss to TCU. And I don't know what will happen with Shaka after, but all five of those losses seem to kind of be in the exact same vein of, like, we were favored, we had every reason to win, we kind of unquestionably are the better team. We need these wins to happen, and then they just don't. And whether they don't happen spectacularly or sort of unspectacularly or whatever the thing is, but this was another loss where I think that if Texas had won that game against TCU, no one would kind of be saying anything. Like, we'd be like, oh, Shaka, he still needs to get better, but it was a good win. Yeah. We're going to go to the tournament. But this loss, whether it takes your belief away from what he can do ultimately or not, I just don't know how you can look at it and say anything other than, like, wow, that's a fucking terrible loss. Like, that's really, really bad. And if this is teetering on some kind of precipice of yes or no, this is a loss that you just can't overlook the fact that it's going to weigh heavily on that no side. And I don't know how to put it other than that, than, like, it's just a really, really, really bad loss.
I mean, even coming into this year when, you know, both you and I had higher expectations than how it worked out, obviously. Mm-hmm. I think you were more optimistic than I was, but I wasn't far behind you by any stretch. It still felt like, even though this year had potential, I still felt like next year is what everything was building towards.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there was a scenario at play, especially with sort of the financial factors involved, et cetera, where, like, Shaka could put forth a quote unquote good enough season with, let's call it, you know, 18-14 or, you know, 20-11 or somewhere in that, you know, somewhere in that range that was like less than we thought they were capable of, but still good enough to get in the tournament and maybe they win a game, or, you know, maybe they finish fourth or fifth in the Big 12 or something, you know. And it's like sort of that middle range where it's like, okay, well, it's better than it was the previous year. It's a step forward, kind of a mini step forward. And then next year was like the year where everything sort of seemed like it was supposed to line up. And I don't know how much of that is sort of the you know, innate Cubs fan in all humans, where it's like, well, next year, you know. But it did feel like there was sort of, I felt like it was building towards, okay, like Rick Barnes's last year, that was the year I felt like, okay, he's got the formula he wants. He's got this group of like reasonably experienced players, and he's got this lottery level talent coming in that like, this is the kind of the thing he like, this is the test case for what Barnes really wanted to build. Like, this was what he wanted to make his way towards a, you know, hopefully another Final Four with, and it failed. And it was like, okay, all right, we've had the control sample. We see how it is. And that's enough. Like, we got enough data. And I have felt for the past year that this next season, the 2019-2020 season was going to be that control sample year of, okay, if Shaka can't make that work, then I've got enough data. Like, I've got, yeah, it's close to the, you know, control sample as I possibly can have with what I think Shaka's trying to build. And I, after the TCU game, it feels like the last of the people who were sort of nominally on his side are gone. And they went, yeah, I don't, you know, yeah, 16 and 15, I'm not going to put up with that. You know, context being what it is, I'm not going to put up with that. So,
well, and so much of what we thought about at the end of last year, and I was as guilty about this as anybody, is, well, if only we had Andrew Jones, if only he was around, think of the difference that he would have made. And that's, yep, true, right? It's yeah, true, but from the same standpoint, like, I think it's impossible to ignore the fact that we have found ways to lose. Like, we, yeah, found ways to allow Baylor to come back for that 19-point, you know, lead that we had. We found ways to allow Oklahoma State to jump out to a 20-point lead against us in Stillwater. We found ways to allow Radford and VCU to kind of stay in the game. We found ways to allow TCU to just manhandle us. Like, we just, yep, you know, and I can point to whatever I want about, well, Andrew Jones is a good enough player that he could have done this, and what, you know, but you can't avoid, like, I hate railing, well, I do in some ways despise sort of the what I think is the kind of the ridiculous notion that's sort of contextless about the win-loss quota.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, like you said, like, what do you, it's 16 and 15. And even if we look and say, well, if we didn't have Kerwin, well, I was calling for less minutes for Kerwin a month ago, and now we've gotten way less minutes, of course. But, right, you know, so it's just really difficult to look at this and say anything other than, well, if we found a way to lose with pretty much everybody that he's had so far, why wouldn't we have found a way to lose if we had things exactly how we wanted them to be?
Yeah, and I feel like it is both valid to consider sort of the shitty luck he's been dealt in terms of Andrew Jones's cancer and, you know, injuries to, like, Cam Ridley and Tevin Mack being a dipshit and, you know, whatever you want to come up with. It's valid to note some of those things that are out of his control, but at the same time, you know, he's not producing with, like, this team outside of Roach is entirely his. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of young guys who I think will be better 2 years from now than they are now. He's significantly better in some cases, but they're still his guys. And right, it is still up to him to construct a roster that has the sort of experience and the capabilities to demonstrate the type of program he wants this to be. And either he has not done it reliably, or this is what he wants it to be, and he's just not saying it. Which I don't really think he's the type to be like, yeah, 16-15. That's where I'm going, right there. Like, I want to be a bubble team every year. This is right, what I like excitement in my seasons. So you hit a certain point where you're like, all right, well, I mean, 4 years is a lot of data on a guy. And
yeah,
whether you, you know, how much you want to attribute to him or luck or, you know, the preceding context he's had to overcome and or his lack of ability to overcome whatever, like, you know, he's had a lot of decision points throughout the last 4 years. And I mean, we are where we are. Win-loss record is not everything, but ultimately it's everything. Like, you know, you can make the case of, okay, well, we're three plays away from being the third seed in the Big 12 tournament. And it's a different sort of vibe about this season right now. But at the same time, it wouldn't be a ton different. There'd still be a lot of people who are either on the fence or not on board with him. Like, it's not like Texas being a, you know, we'll call it 11-7 in conference and a 3 seed or 4 seed is going to be like, oh, wow, he's definitely the answer to a lot of the people who don't want him.
Yeah.
So, so I guess my question here is, I don't think, let me phrase it as a statement and then a question. I don't think the TCU game is what ends Shaka's career at Texas. But is it fair to say that maybe it is the final straw on a series of straws on that camel's back?
It is a big enough straw that at this point if the collective understanding of what Chris Del Conte has in mind for sort of the athletic department in general is that he's the kind of guy who will never hesitate to make the bet what he deems the best choice for the program. If I thought that before the TCU game, he was making the prudent decision to say, it's going to cost us a shit ton to get rid of Shaka. We've done enough, or he's done enough that I, you know, we can understand giving him another year. If I thought that was a reasonable choice at that point, I convergently kind of think this, if CDC were to come out tomorrow and be like, look, we're going to find someplace else for him to be, or we're going to find some reason for Shaka not to be here or give him some other options or whatever. I would have no problems or qualms with that at this point. I just, you know, that was given everything put together, how big of a game that could have been, how much we played like ass, how much the fan base has obviously turned on Shaka at this point, how much, you know, even if you said we're going to lose some recruits we've got coming in next year, like I could see a lot of fans being like, okay, fine, like whatever, it makes no difference. On top of the fact that, you know, there is some potentially other coaches out there that are appealing, I guess, from whatever standpoint you would ask them to be. I don't know that any of those coaches are as appealing as Shaka seemed 4 years ago, but but you know, the loss against TCU, if that was if the only back that matters is Del Conte's, if that was the straw that for Del Conte really kind of broke whatever will he had to keep Shaka here because that was the easiest or the most reasonable option. If that was the case, I don't know how I could say boo to him.
I mean, there's a lot of layers to this, so let me try and tease them out a little bit. One is that I don't think any single game is a determining factor for someone who is an athletic director at a major university. Mm-hmm. I just don't think that they, if they're competent at their job, they are allowing a single game to be like, okay, that's it. Like, I feel like if Del Conte has said, okay, we got to go some other way, then he was already leaning that way, and this was the final game that did it for him. Like, he was, if he's like, let's put it this way, if he is at a point where he is looking for replacements for Shaka, he was already considering looking at replacements for Shaka. And while I think it is important for us to make note of the difference in hiring for a football versus a basketball coach, or more to the point, buying out a football versus a basketball coach at Texas, where almost, I mean, I don't remember exactly 90%, but it's somewhere in the range of, if Texas is a $200 million revenue institution athletically, $180 million of that is football. And the vast majority of that $20 million is still basketball. But when you got a guy with $13 million-ish left guaranteed, punting that, you know, the better part of a year of revenue to tell a coach you don't want him to go, much less the other expenses that are involved in hiring the new coach, et cetera, that's an enormous expense for basketball.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is fair to apply that sort of context when you're looking at who goes, you know, who goes, who stays, you know, no, if this is baseball, if this was softball, if this is volleyball, no one would be like, yeah, $13 million is nothing. It's just, mm-hmm. they think basketball is a sort of a bigger revenue beast than it is. So anyway, point being is that I feel like this may not be a catalyst in the traditional sense so much as, I mean, I guess it is the catalyst if he is moving forward. But at the same time, the reason I'm hedging on this is that the texts and the messages I started getting about Shaka's job status happened before the end of the game.
Yeah.
So like, if this really was the catalyst, I don't think I would have started getting those until 20, 30 minutes after the game, whereas I was getting them not long after halftime. And while Texas was not playing great during half, at half, like they were down, you know, what was it, 9 points or whatever at halftime,
yeah.
that's still a very manageable thing to come back from. So I feel like it's, I feel like this decision was probably in process prior to the TCU game, and I just, I found out what I found out during and after the TCU game. So so that's why I sort of, you know, I don't want to say reject, but I don't entirely agree with this idea that the TCU game was the catalyst, because I feel like things started to be in motion prior to that. And I guess there's some validity to that in that Texas was 8-9. They were 1-3 in the last four going into that. You know, you still had 3.8 years of data or whatever. So I guess it's probably prudent at this point to sort of talk about what the status is of Shaka's job. To my understanding at this point, and I think I should lay out sort of the scenarios at play here, because there's a handful of them at play. And some of them are more likely than others, but there are multiple non-zero percentages here. So I want to make sure I'm sort of giving a lay of the land. The guaranteed money left, the, you know, 12.9, 13 million, wherever it's at for Shaka, that is a very real barrier in this situation, because it's not football. It's a huge number to tell a guy to go away when you still have to hire the other person. And if they have buyouts involved and they have, you know, there's a lot of other expenses before you, you know, that to get that 13 million in get that out of the way is a big deal before you even deal with hiring whoever you want to hire. So given the donor's relative lack of desire, to my understanding, to foot that bill for the $13 million, Del Conte has to come up with a way to make that palatable. And a number that size involves the university itself signing off. It involves a lot of other factors. So it's not just Del Conte going, I don't want to pay that. It's, I don't think I have the will of the people with the purse strings to pay that. So what he is faced with right now is effectively, how do I get that number down to where it is more palatable to the people who have checkbooks, be it donors, be it the university, whoever? So the most likely path, and what I think they are working on right now, is if Shaka, in his contract, if to what I understand, if he leaves for another job, be it UCLA or Duke or the Bulls or, you know, Gardner Webb, wherever he goes, whatever that school or that program pays him is offset from his guarantee. So let's just say that, like, he goes to UCLA, just to use it as an example. If UCLA says, we're going to pay you, we're going to give you a four-year deal worth $6 million. Well, that $6 million comes out of the guarantee. So the guarantee Texas is now on hook for is like 7 instead of 13, which is a substantial reduction in what they owe. And I believe that Del Conte feels like if he can get a significant reduction on that order, it will be palatable enough that either donors will help kick in, the university will kick in, some combination thereof, so that they can move on. So it is in the vested interest of the university to help him find a landing spot. I believe that Shaka is pretty frustrated with his situation here and sort of how things have gone. So he's probably not averse to moving on. That it could be something that sort of helps both parties. Shaka gets a reset somewhere. Texas gets to go find someone else. And the money becomes much less of a factor. I think that is what they are working towards right now. Now, there are a couple other possible outcomes here that I will call less desirable because it starts to get really awkward. Is one, if Texas, let's say they beat Kansas, make it in the tournament, or they beat Kansas, they make it to like the Big 12 conference finals, just as a possibility here. Because, you know, Dean Wade is out for Kansas State for the tournament, and maybe Texas Tech's bus never gets out of Lubbock because Lubbock is actually under a giant biodome, so they have to forfeit. So Texas makes it to the Big 12 tournament finals, and or they make it to, like, let's just say they make it to the Sweet 16, just as an example here. It is going to be hard to get rid of a coach who just went to the Sweet 16 in his fourth year. Maybe it helps in leverage with wherever landing spot they're trying to come with, but maybe it's enough of a progression in status that he goes, all right, well, maybe I can stick it out and next year will be something special. In which case things get really awkward and he would probably come back at that point. The other option is, that what if nobody wants to foot that much of the buyout? Say UCLA goes, all right, we're interested, but we only want to pay like 4 years, $4 million. And that's our final offer. You can foot him the other $2+ million per year. That's it. Give, you know, take it or leave it. And that's not enough of a reduction to make it palatable. Then maybe Shaka comes back. Now, neither of those two latter scenarios sound really desirable, both from a fan standpoint, from a writer standpoint, from, you know, I mean, it'd be juicy as hell as a writer, I guess, but like, it doesn't sound desirable. When I wrote the thing on Barking Carnival, and it's part of why I hedged on it, is that there are scenarios in which he could potentially come back. And they're not non-zero. Like, it's not meteor strike sort of situations. So, while I think he's more likely gone than not, I'm not going to say for sure he is gone because of those scenarios. Tim, have you heard anything different, similar? What have you heard on your side of things?
Almost exactly the same. Yeah, I still think there's a decent amount of intrigue around what the athletic department will ultimately end up doing. So I think that a lot of what's going to happen over the next month or so is going to be trying to ascertain a number of things. How much money does the athletic department feel comfortable spending on Shaka at this point? How much money do they think they can get from someone else or from another institution for him? How 100% do they feel about who they would go after next? What are the financial pieces at play with that? You know, so I you know, that's going to be a guessing game because who knows, you know, what kind of coaches are out there or interested in Texas or where we're going to go ultimately go and what does CDC kind of value most as far as what he hopes to bring in. I mean, there's already some names trickling out there, none of which I'm super comfortable putting out there at this point. But suffice to say, there's some that I'm intrigued by, and some of them are like, nah. I'm actually not particularly excited about a couple of the names I've heard so far. So, but you know, again, that's hearsay, and I don't, you know, that's we'll see what happens as time goes on. But it's, you know, in a lot of ways, I think that Del Conte with Herman has obviously kind of given Herman and his staff the wherewithal to bring in the kind of support staff that he needs to be successful. He's obviously done a terrific job of drumming up excitement around DKR and what happens for game days there for football. And so you look at that and say, hey, this could be pretty cool. On the other hand, like, some of that shit was pretty obvious. Like Herman was on his doorstep. Yeah. Herman, you know, Herman was a guy who was obviously angling for this job, and really, like, it would be tough to fuck up. That's not the case for basketball. Like, there are some guys around that you could say, hey, this makes a lot of sense, but they're going to be costly. There's some guys around that I think could fit Texas pretty well, but you know, I would have said the exact same thing about Shaka Smart. And so there's certainly...
I did say the same thing about Shaka Smart.
Yeah, so there's clearly some question marks here, no matter how you want to lay it. And it's... Yeah, the next... If it becomes as clear as I think it will here over the next week or so that the end for Shaka at Texas is underway, it's going to be fascinating to kind of put the puzzle pieces together of who are we actually going after? What does that look like? What do the finances look like? How are we going to find a landing spot for Shaka? When does that happen? How shortly after the tournament is done do we get our person, you know, that will come in? So it's, yeah, there's a lot of moving pieces that I'll be fascinated to see here over the next 21 to 30 days.
I am alternatively fascinated by the machinations of it all, and sad because I feel like this is a coaching staff that could have worked out. They don't seem to have at this point, and I get it, but I just wish God damn it, Will. Fucking cue cards from our mute producer. All right, we're being forced at gunpoint to talk about Chris Beard because Will is wearing his Texas Tech gear right now, and it's a little disturbing, but he does control the MP3s, so
here tortillas we go. Are flying everywhere.
Yeah.
Dough goes so, in. Tortilla comes out. You can't explain that.
Your Bane impression got really bad there.
I know. Just,
yeah, it's awful.
That's my voice. That's why I'm not talking today. All right. That's it for me.
Thank you, Epileptic Steve. I don't know what that was. That was a bad voice. So Chris Beard, since he is the, like, we're not really gonna go into a bunch of coaches today because we'll have plenty of time for that later, if and when Shaka gets let go or, you know, quote unquote moves on. But we'll talk about Beard a little bit here because he is the primary name. He is the people that are the coach that people seem to adore. So Tim, what are your initial thoughts on sort of the idea of Beard coming here and, you know, how you feel about it?
He makes a lot of sense. Clearly, he's someone that's invested in the college. He's obviously not opposed to leaving whatever program he's at, no matter how long he's been there or how right he seems to have things going. Look, from a overall programmatic standpoint, you cannot help but be impressed at the last 2 years of what Beard has been able to accomplish. It's weird, though, right? It's a little bit weird. Like, if Texas had wanted Jarrett Culver and Zaire Smith, both of those guys were there for the taking. We chose not to take them. So that's why those guys ended up at Tech, because we chose not to have them. Now, apparently, those are both terrible choices to not have those guys come in. But look, I think Beard is a little rough around the edges. Well, okay, let me say it like this. I have... when Shaka was brought in at Texas, there was a faction of Longhorn fandom that really wanted Greg Marshall, that saw what he was doing at Wichita State.
Yes.
And thought to themselves,
famously friendly Greg Marshall,
right? And like saw his success that he was having in the NCAA tournament, and saw the fact that he was bringing in some of these players who had pro aspirations, like a Van Vliet, like that Baker kiddo, like I can't remember their 6'7" guy who was, you know, ended up playing the league for a little while. Anyways, like he was that guy. To me, Beard sort of resembles a lot of what I don't like about Marshall. A lot of kind of the tough attitude around him, the way that he deals with some of the media, the very methodical way that he approaches offense. Now, I mean, it's tough though. Their last 9 or 10 games, they've been offensively extremely good. They're riding a super hot streak. So that's tough. That's a little bit tougher sell for me to make at this point. But look, I know that people look at how well they have played and say, wow, that's pretty good. I don't know that I can look at what he's done with Jarrett Culver or just how good Jarrett Culver has played and say, yep, that's Beard. That's his influence. Or look at Mooney and say, yep, because of how good Mooney has played, that's Beard and his influence. Or, yep, Tariq Owens, you know, look how good he it's just tough. Like, we're talking about grad transfers. We're talking about freshmen coming in who've had huge impacts. And you know, as much as we can look at Shaka's experience at Texas and say, well, he hasn't gotten it done, you can, I guess, say the same, you know, the opposite, you know, when it comes to Beard. But I'm not convinced he's the slam dunk that maybe a lot of people just assume or hope he would be. That being said, I would not be surprised at all if he's the next coach at Texas here and you know, by the summer.
Yeah, I think so. Let's just from a let me take two tacks here. One is sort of the program building slash, you know, offense defense side of him, and then I'll address the financial side. Defensively, he is without question. He is a very good defensive coach. He is obviously put together with his Pac-Line defense and sort of the ways he tweaks it. He is extremely good on the defensive side, and that is laudable. That will win you a lot of games. I mean, see what he's done. We'll see what Virginia does. Like, there's you can win a lot of games by playing really good defense. This is not the NBA where there are dudes who can hit 43% despite being guarded from three. Like, you can lock other teams down with defense. So there's a lot of value there. Never mind that that's what Shaka had the reputation for when he got here. Offensively, I have a lot more questions. It's not that he has no identity on offense. He very much loves the motion offense. Like, he's sort of a Bobby Knight disciple in that way. It's that his offensive output, like, if they have had a like Tim said, the last, you know, 8 to 10 games, they have hit an incredibly high offensive streak, or like that they've had their ceiling has been lifted a lot in the last several games. Having said that, they're still the fourth best offense in the Big 12, which is by efficiency standpoints, which is, this has not been a good offensive year for the Big 12 as a whole. Like, he has a potential top five pick and a litany of upperclassmen around him who are mostly transfers, grad transfers, that type of thing. And he's still putting together an offense that is middle of the pack, at least in terms of the Big 12. He has not had to deal with sort of the building an offense with the inexperience that Shaka has, for example. So I don't know that his offense would be as good, nearly as good. I mean, as a matter of fact, if you watch the first 15 games or so of them this year, their offense was really bad. It was lower half of the big, or lower half of D1, for the first half of the year. So I've got questions offensively. Also, he has a pretty limited track record. I mean, if we're trying to learn lessons from Shaka, if we were trying to come up with, okay, what about Barnes worked so well and why was he able to be successful? What about Shaka? Did we miss or did we maybe overestimate? I think if we are going the route of let's find a defensive-minded coach with a limited track record and one NCAA tournament run to his name, we just did that. And Beard may eventually be better, but I don't think it's a home run, like Tim said. I also think that just as, for example, Shaka came into a situation that had a lot of ticking time bombs, namely the roster situation after his first year when he lost his top seven guys, Beard has not had to really deal with that. Like, he came into Tech after Tubby laid the groundwork with what was a borderline NCAA tournament level squad, and he kept most of those guys. And to his credit, he added to that, and he brought in transfers, and he supplemented. Like, he has done things to help that, so I don't want to take away what he's done, but in terms of context, he did not build Tech from the ground up. And it would be sort of amusing if he parlayed a couple years off of building off of what Tubby did with going to Texas and building off of what Shaka did. You know, I mean, maybe that's sort of the Phil Jackson school of success, where it's as much about hitting the right moment as anything, capitalizing on the situation as anything. But he could very well end up being a very high-level coach for Texas or Tech or wherever he ends up long-term. I don't think it's a home run. I think it's probably fair to say that at least in the fans' eyes, he's the favorite to land the job, and his name gets mentioned more often than others. So it would not surprise me that he ends up being the coach. From the financial side of things, if you are looking at what Texas is going through in terms of sort of the contortions that they're going through to try and find a way to get Shaka another gig, the sort of barriers you're dealing with of a $13 million buyout or whatever portion of that they have to pay. It's also worth noting that Chris Beard's buyout for Texas or any Big 12 school is 40% of his remaining deal, which I believe is somewhere in the range of $7 million. That's just to get him into the building. So you're looking at a situation where if Texas is struggling to come up with a way to fund, I mean, let's say Shaka finds a job where half of his guarantee is offset. They've had to contort themselves in a number of ways for $6.5 million savings, because they didn't have the stomach for $13 million. So you're going to tell me the people who just went through all of these gymnastics to save $6.5 million are going to immediately drop down $6+ million to go get Beard. Plus whatever you're going to pay him, which will be a guaranteed deal again, because that's table stakes in a high major D1. You're going to look at, to get Beard out of that situation, it's going to probably have to be a substantial pay raise. So let's say 5 years, $20 million. All guaranteed. So you're watching a program, you're watching an athletic department who is struggling over somewhere in the neighborhood of $6 million. You think they're going to be willing to throw down $20 million guaranteed immediately after that? Plus, you know, the $6-7 million to get Beard out of Tech? That seems like a tall request based on how they've acted to this point. It's not impossible. It may happen. Maybe what's happening is some donors out there saying, all right, if you can get past this buyout, I'll drop you $4 million towards whatever Beard costs or something. Who knows? Like, there's a lot of variables out there that can make this work that we're not accounting for. But it feels like it's financially a much taller task than going after someone else who's more readily available, who might also be a pretty good coach, who's just not the trendy name out there. Because there are always other coaches out there. I mean, Nate Oates at Buffalo is doing some pretty impressive things, and you can get him a hell of a lot cheaper than $20 million, I bet. So, I mean, just to throw a name out there. So Beard may end up being the guy. And, you know, I have sort of mixed thoughts on whether or not he should be the guy. But at the same time, it could be him. But if we're going to look at perspective on the sort of pros and cons, the whys and why nots of Chris Beard, it's impossible to talk about it without talking about the financial commitments involved with getting a guy like that.
Yep. That's true.
Thank you, Tim. I appreciate that. That was good stuff.
I enjoyed listening to it. Honestly, I agree with what you said. It was good.
Well, thank you. And on that note, since it's been like an hour and I haven't made any dick jokes in a while, I feel like we should probably end it off because those are coming sooner than later.
Gross.
Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you for listening to Pretend We're Football for the last, I don't know, 55, 60 minutes. You can find us on the Hornscast channel on Podbean, Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, basically everywhere other than SoundCloud. Yeah. We're not on there anymore because, you know, that shit costs money and we are not rolling in it yet. Although, if Beard gets in, we're going to get some residuals, right? I think that's what's going to happen. So
rate us 5 stars and 5 points only, please.
Yeah, we get a penny per star. So, you know, please add those up. So, Will, you're mute. So I'm going to say you can find him on Twitter and Reddit and Instagram and anywhere that allows a computer to access it at Will Baizer, WILLBAIZER, or SpongeBob Fan Forever on Pinterest. He's on there. That's always a good one. That's his sock account, but he's on there a lot.
Krabby Patty 6969.
Yeah, exactly right. Tim, we're gonna do this a little differently this week since it's just the two of us.
Oh, okay.
Since I'm not gonna tell you where you are. You're going to come up with some magical place you are. So where in the world, Tim, can we find Timothy Preston?
There is a...
Was that... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that was perfect. That was... I feel like this is old school, and I'm... what's his name? John Carville or whatever? That was perfect. We have nothing to say. InsideTexas.com and on Twitter, InsideTexasHoop, no S. Also found out that there is going to be a new Taco John's opening up not far from my house. Taco John's is a kind of a regional sort of thing. Do they have those in St. Louis, Will? You can shake your head yes or no. All right, they're delicious. They have a thing called the old Taco Bravo. What the Taco Bravo is it's a taco. Hard shell, of course. But on the outside of that taco, they have a soft shell that has been covered in beans and then wrapped around the taco itself. Delicious. There's a new one.
I believe Taco Bell created that about 10 years ago. It's called the Gordita.
You're thinking of what they call the old double-decker taco, my friend. It's and this is actually the Taco Bravo. It precedes the double-decker taco. You're welcome. But Taco John started in Cheyenne, Wyoming by a guy named Juan, although Juan was a little bit too Mexican-y, apparently, so they went with Taco John's instead. They have a little thing called what they call potato olays, which are just hash browns that have some delicious seasoning on them. So once that restaurant comes in close to my house, there's two of them here in Cedar Rapids, but one's going to be very close to my house. Once it does come in, I'm going to spend a lot of my free time there. They also have what they call churros. I don't know if you've heard of those before. They're a fried, delicious dessert kind of treat. And also, when I've gone there in the past, they'll give me a plastic cup, and then I can have all the water I can drink. They're just like, yeah, have all the water you want, which is great. So I can just, if I want more water, I walk up and with the dispenser, more water. It's really quite good. Yeah. Sometimes.
Where on the basketball court can we find you?
Well,
are you holding a churro while you're playing basketball?
I don't even like churros. They're not very good. But if I am on the basketball court, there's three places in particular that you can find me. The first is, I spend a lot of time. Look, it's 2019. I spend a lot of time camped out around the 3-point line. That's really where I feel most comfortable. is shooting from deep. But I'm probably most comfortable going inside with the big boys and taking it right to the rim. But really where I feel the most comfortable is right in your fucking face.
And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Bitter White Guy. Also Reddit, where apparently people have realized I exist.
15-year-olds in particular.
Yes, obnoxious 15-year-olds with terrible opinions seem to really enjoy telling me I'm dumb and or throwing a slur in my direction. It's like Xbox Live, really, just text form.
Kill yourself.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. So thank you, guys. Hope you join us next week when we have some sort of funeral for the season, I guess. Or no, maybe that's 2 weeks away. Maybe it's 2 weeks away. It could be 2 weeks away. We could spend next week talking about the beauties of the NIT. Anyway, thanks for joining us. Tim?
Oh, hook 'em.